My name's Ivo Dorney. I'm involved in the National Trust and launching this event. We're very pleased to see you here. We're particularly pleased to see our guest speakers today. In fact, one of them, Anne Applebaum, is responsible for the name of this whole this little anecdote. She's responsible for the name Mount Stuart Conversations, which may perhaps be not the most gripping name on earth. But the reason for it was because when I put to her that our keenness to get her to come and talk to us, I said what we could do is we could try and find someone from Russian television who represents as holy writ everything that Putin says as complete truth. And then you could fight on stage, possibly in mud, and we would have at least an entertainment of some kind. And Anne said immediately, actually, I'm sorry, I'm fed up with doing that. I've done it so often before. What I'd really like to do is have a conversation. And we suddenly realized that actually Mount Stuart was a place where probably quite a lot of things were disputed and quite often quite hard, but in a civilized way and in the form of discussion rather than long speeches or angry disputes. So it's a delight that Anne is here, having named the event this weekend, even if that wasn't her intention. She is, of course, a very distinguished historian, academic, commentator, journalist, and the winner of a Pulitzer Prize, not a common thing to encounter in the United Kingdom, for her amazing book, Gulag. And she is, of course, a specialist in the history of Eastern Europe and Russia. Alongside her, we have Alex Titov from the Queen's University Belfast, who is indeed a specialist in Russian foreign policy, educated at Leeds and Birmingham, and taught at Leeds and Birmingham, among other places. I think I got that right, Alex.
UCL.
Who is familiar, probably, with hearing not entirely favorable things said about Russia from time to time. We are very lucky. I am particularly lucky, as I was frightened I was going to have to chair this meeting from a position of no knowledge, that we have the very distinguished John Bew, who some of you will have seen earlier today, who has agreed to act as our chairman. So thanks for coming, and enjoy. John.
Thank you. Thank you. Ivo's opening remarks and his very kind remarks introducing us suggest that I have much more knowledge than he does, but that's not necessarily true. So I will aim to keep this as informal a conversation as possible, drawing on Alex and Nan's expertise. And I want to start with a kind of a what in cricketing parlance might be called, you've been in the UK long enough to have heard these phrases, a bouncer. Mm. So my bouncer to you, Anne, is, are we in a new is the West in a new Cold War with Russia?
Right. Well, first of all, thank you for that question. Thank you for inviting me. Ivo, thank you for saying that I gave such a boring name to this event, which I guess was kind of a compliment. And thank you, John. I don't believe for one second that you're ignorant, so I'm looking forward to talking to both of you. So are we in a new Cold War? It's an interesting question. I usually get asked that question a little bit differently, or it's usually thrown at me differently, which is that I'm often accused of being a Cold Warrior. You know, why? Because I've been critical of Russian foreign policy and indeed Russian domestic policy. I talk a lot about Russian history, including recent history, but also going back, you know, several decades. And so people say, you know, you're just trying to revive the Cold War. Why are you anti-Russian? You know, why are you trying to bring back a problem that we thought was gone? And the answer to that is complicated. I mean, first of all, I spent most of the 1990s being very committed to the cause of Russian transformation. And I believed very much that there would be a different kind of Russia and that there would be a Russian-Western partnership. And so my current views don't reflect a continuation, but are rather a break and a rather a recognition of something that's changed. And second of all, I would say that, well, I don't believe we're in a Cold War, and I don't think this is the 1980s or the 1970s. I do think we are involved now in an ideological competition with Russia that I think we're not even aware of. So in other words, you know, if somebody's having a Cold War, they're having a Cold War with us, and we're not yet aware that it's even going on. It doesn't involve the whole world. It's not, you know, communism versus capitalism. It's not that clear cut. It's a little bit different from what it used to be. But the Russians, and I'm sure Professor Titov is going to say this, I mean, the Russians feel themselves very much, to be coming from a different place now from the West, and they feel their system needs defense from the West, and it needs not just military defense, it needs ideological defense and kind of an information policy defense, if that's the right expression for it. And they have begun, a very clear campaign, which is designed, first of all, to defend themselves from ideas from the West that they feel are undermining them, but also to undermine us. Let me take a step back and explain that just for a second. The Russians do have a strategy. They see the world, the main competition they see is in Europe, but they care also about the United States, and their strategy is to undermine the West, to undermine NATO, to undermine the European Union, and to the extent that they can, to undermine the system of global, roughly described globalization trade. Why do they want to do this? They want to do this, first of all, because they feel that I don't really mean the Russians, I mean the Kremlin, and I mean the Russian ruling class, and I can be more specific about that later if you want. Putin and the people around him, generally speaking. They believe that the sort of post-1989 settlement was unfair, that it left Russia weaker than it should be and with less influence than it should be in the world, and they would like to reverse it and they would like to upset it. This, by the way, makes them quite different from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was in many ways, certainly by the latter half of its existence, was very much in favor of stability and in favor of, keeping the world in a certain way, and that was why it had a balancing relationship with the United States. Putin's Russia is a revisionist power. It wants to change. It wants to change the way that power is distributed in Europe. It would like to regain influence over the old Soviet space. It would like to regain influence in Central Europe and even Western Europe if it can. Why is it doing this? I mean, there's a set of reasons. It's quite logical. One of the reasons is that Putin believes that to maintain his own political system, and this is a kleptocracy. It's not a democracy. It's profoundly corrupt. The system is both run and owned by the same people. So literally, the people who run Russia also own its major companies. The people who sit on the board of Gazprom also work in the president's office, and so on. And to maintain that system, the greatest threat to that system is the idea of democracy. The idea of democracy or the idea of a street revolution in the form of the Orange Revolution in Ukraine or later the Euromaidan Revolution in Ukraine. Maybe this is illogical because, if you look at Russia right now, you don't see a massive revolution happening. Those one or two moments when there has been hints of the possibility of a street revolution, as there were in 2011, Putin became very angry. He blamed the West for creating it, for provoking it. He actually blamed Hillary Clinton, which is, maybe we'll have a talk about that a little bit later, she was then Secretary of State, whom he identified with the street revolution. And he sees the idea of democracy, the idea of revolution, as something that's coming from the West and that's designed to unseat him personally. He has, his reasons for thinking this. First of all, he's seen these things happen now in Ukraine a couple of times. His personal experience is also important. Remember, in 1989, he worked for the KGB in East Germany, and he was a witness to the 1989 street revolution, in the fall of the wall in East Germany, and he saw how devastating it was to his friends, to his colleagues in East Germany, and of course to himself personally. I mean, he's you know, I don't know whether it's true or not, but he's spoken and written about having to burn files and essentially escape from Germany with his tail between his legs. And so he's been very adamant about not wanting to repeat that experience. So this experience of street violence, so he needs to undermine the idea of democracy. He also needs to undermine our street push democracy, and he's undermined the idea of Europe. Because for Russians, and for Ukrainians as well, you know, what is the alternative to Putinism? You know, what could it be? And for many Russians, I mean, it's funny, you know, as we now watch the appeal of Europe and of the European idea, you know, fall away in this country, you know, the appeal is still very strong in places like Ukraine. I mean, what does Europe mean to Ukrainians? It means rule of law. It means democracy. It means free trade. It means a system that works. As opposed to their own system, which is still very much like the Russian system. It's profoundly corrupt. It's controlled by very few rich men. And so the European idea remains appealing. It remains appealing to Russians as well for exactly the same reasons. And, you know, it's not an accident that during the Euromaidan demonstrations, people were waving the European flag, which, again, must have looked very strange to people in London. But they were. So the undermining of Europe is sort of ideologically and politically important to Europe, and of course the undermining of NATO as well, the undermining of America's role in Europe. All these things to him are important because it's about keeping himself in power, and it's also, of course, about keeping his control over Russian money and over Russian politics. I don't want to go on too long in my first introduction, but I'll just say that the tools that he uses some are obvious and some are less so. They're political and they're economic and they're sort of what I would call, you know, informational, or I mean I don't like the word propaganda, but they're informational or disinformational. Politically, many people know this, although it's not as well known as it should be. He has offered support, both financial and moral, to both far-right and far-left parties in Europe. So he funds Marine Le Pen's party in France, and that's one that we know. He funds Jobbik in Hungary, which is a far-right Hungarian in Europe. This is another one that we know, because we know who the go-between is. There are suspicions. He certainly has strong relationships with other parties. And, of course, the interesting thing about his relationships with European political parties is that, you know, in the olden days, you know, the Soviet Union supported communist parties. Now, it's really not about a right or left-wing ideology. It's about whoever is anti-European, who's ever anti-systemic, whoever is working on breaking up the system. And so, you know, Russia Today, which is their sort of official state Russian media, state channel, which broadcasts in English, is very often features far-left figures. You know, George Galloway is on it. Julian Assange used to be on it. And it pushes a kind of anti-state, anti-systemic, anti-capitalist line. And at the same time, as I say, they support the far-right. So there's a political piece of the story. There's an economic piece. The Russians seek, in almost every country in Europe, to buy access or to buy relationships or to make relationships with big economic actors. Works some places better than others. You know, in Germany, they have some very strong relationships with German companies. It's particularly the extractive industries, oil and gas. In Italy, they have very strong economic relationships. So they seek to gain influence in often by buying into I don't know whether it's the electricity grid or the local gas industry. They seek to buy into industries that are influential, and this is again part of a logical strategy to increase their power. And then the third piece of it, as I said, is informational, and this is a use of open methods like RT, more covert methods like creating disinformation, creating fake websites, fake news stories. Using a troll army, this is very well documented, that runs out of St. Petersburg and probably other places, trying to manipulate social media, again, to support the same ideas. Not necessarily pro-Russian, but in each country, as I said, adjusted to the local politics. Anti-systemic, anti-EU, anti-American, anti-NATO, whether it's far right or far left or mainstream. And this is a, so I'll stop there because I know you want to make this a conversation as not a monologue. But the point of me giving you this introduction is that you started with the question, is this a Cold War? And the answer is, we haven't seen it that way yet. You know, we haven't seen this as a kind of ideological competition, but they do. And they are acting as if it were. And I do think that there is going to come a moment when we need to begin to perceive what it is as it is and to react to it. So,
okay. Thank you, Anne, for that fantastic opening. I have loads of personal questions in relation to perspectives from Washington, perspectives from London, Brexit, about the nature of that ideology. But I was also cast half an eye on Alex there, who wasn't giving anything away as to what he thought about your opening remarks. So I'm going to hand over to him and see if he has any initial responses before we broaden out the discussion.
Thank you. Well, actually, I mean, there's quite a few points I agree with, and I think the starting point with discussing contemporary Russia is, of course, the experience of the end of the Cold War. And essentially its failure to really westernize and democratize properly. There are a variety of reasons for that, but what we have now is certainly Russia is perceiving itself to be different from the West, different from Europe in many ways. And the next question, what to do about that? One thing I didn't quite agree with them in the sense that having that Russia has this strategy of undermining EU and US, I think that's kind of giving it too much credit in the sense that what I see and the way I understand it is basically they're very opportunistic. You know, they're using various opportunities to advance their own interests if it happens. But the broad Russian interest in this juncture is broadly kind of in line with what was sort of Russia's position has been for many years or many centuries, essentially, is having this building itself up as a great power, having influence, and being engaged with the rest of the world on equal terms. It does go about achieving the same in different ways, particularly issue of propaganda and so forth, but also I think more importantly recently is the issue of increasing reliance on military force as well, because that's one of the areas where Russia has, if not an advantage, but certainly has a big advantage than other areas in the economy, it's quite quick and so forth. But the bottom line of it is that it's actually the other point I wanted to raise is also issues of focusing excessively on Putin himself. Because if it was just Putin and his regime, it would be all very well. No man, no problem, as Lenin used to say. Was it Stalin? I can't remember. But anyway, one of them. You see my drift. But the issue here is much deeper than that, because basically it is that Russia has reached certain limit of its ability to westernize, ability to integrate into Western structure. It exists outside of them, and it tries to carve itself out a place in that new world. And relations with the European Union and NATO are the key points for it in its own perception. Is it a Cold War? I'm not sure it is a Cold War. Obviously, I'm not sure there is a coherent ideology in Russian side as it was in the Cold War, the communist ideology versus capitalism. I think it's much more opportunistic. I think the ideology it shares is more like interwar period in a sense that it's much more nationalism, sort of nation states, great power alliance and so forth than the Cold War, which had a kind of big ideological grip. So there isn't a consistent set of ideas which Russia necessarily pushes forward. I think that what really is worrying for the West and why they became so alarmed with Russia is that essentially, there's a combination of the two things happening, which is one thing is actually nothing to do with Russia, and that's basically a rise of anti-establishment, anti-liberal sentiments in the West, both in European Union, as we see in Brexit, but also in other countries, in Le Pen and so forth, Marie Le Pen, Front National, but also in the United States, so the rise of Donald Trump and so forth. Those forces have natural affinity with what's the type of Russia, Putin, and what they represent, but Putin is not, did not cause their rise. They are indigenous problem for the Western liberal order. Putin is just using opportunity to advance his interests. Yeah? But at the same time, there's also a problem with Russia as being rise, this challenge to the international post-Cold War liberal order as well, on international level. Yeah? So the issue of Ukraine, issue of Syria, whole idea of what Russia is trying to push is idea of illegitimacy of Western-led intervention into around the world, be it in Syria, in Libya or Iraq, that the West does not have this moral right to intervene in other countries, in other regions, unless it's been approved by the Security Council, where Russia has the veto. So, and that's kind of exactly what Anne was saying about the fear of color revolutions, that the Russia indeed is trying to project on international level the same kind of challenge to the liberal world order, the way that locally is being been manifested in the recent years throughout Europe and the United States. I think that's a combination of these two factors actually what is becoming why Russia is becoming such a big problem in Western public mind.
Okay, in a moment I'm going to go back in classic historian fashion to 1989 and ask you to take us through that story a little bit about the fracturing relationship between Russia and the West. But I want to come back to remarks you both made in different ways as to the nature of the ideas or the ideology behind the Russian leadership more broadly from Putin and also the Russian governing classes, and ask you to sort of really pinpoint what you mean about that. Anne, you talked a bit about a kleptocracy. Both of you referred to the fact that there's a strong nationalist sentiment underlying this, you know, a conventional nationalist sense of, one thinks of Germany after the First World War, of being humiliated or not treated equally at the community of nations. That seems to be one driving force, the anti-interventionism, sort of broad anti-Westernism, but it's not so bold or obvious as other forms of anti-Westernism. And I think that's possibly why it's difficult to tackle or come across. So if you could break down both of you, maybe starting with Anne, what is the nature of the ideology?
I agree with you that, first of all, I agree with you absolutely that it's wrong to say this is all about Putin. And sometimes one does it almost as a shorthand, you know, because it's easier to say Putin does X, Putin does Y, rather than break down what you mean. But I mean, you know, who is Putin? Putin comes out of the old KGB, and he is surrounded by people from the old KGB. And the ruling class in Russia is now very much dominated by people who were trained and educated in the KGB and see the world very much through that lens. And they, you know, it's not an accident that they see conspiracies everywhere, that they assume any foreign presence inside Russia is, you know, represents a foreign, you know, a foreign attempt to overthrow them. It's not an accident that they've outlawed all kinds of foreign groups in Russia, including groups who were there to do, you know, aid tuberculosis patients and so on. I mean, they very much see the world as a kind of, you know, as a series of operations aimed at them, and that kind of conditions, you know, that conditions how they then behave. Also, I agree, it's very complicated to use the word ideology. I mean, I sort of go back and forth about whether to use it or not, because what it mostly is a philosophy of self-preservation. Again, who is Putin? How did he come to power? As I said, he started in the KGB. There have been a number of extremely good books in the last couple of years tracing his, how he got from, you know, running home, burning the files in Dresden to taking power. And essentially it was done through theft, through aligning himself with the Russian mafia as it then was, and through, you know, in essence, he was part of a group of people who saw the opportunities in the early 1990s, got hold of, I mean, I'm now being very broad, this is a very broad brush version of it, but got hold of assets inside Russia, took the money abroad, laundered it abroad, and by the way, we played a big role in helping them launder it in this country and in the United States, but particularly here, and then brought it back. And they you know, they in effect stole the assets of the Russian state and privatized them into their own hands. And then they weren't the only ones doing this, but you know, there was a kind of power struggle. It went on for a decade or so, and Putin became you're absolutely right, he's not the only person, but he's sort of the center of a spider web. He's like the mafia don. You know, he seems to have influence over, and people want him in power because he controls other people and so on. But it is very much a kleptocracy. It is very much a state which is run and owned by the same people. And so the ideology fundamentally is about keeping those people in power. And that's why it can seem haphazard and inconsistent, and it's not, you know, it's not like they have a, you know, Marx and they derive everything they say from Marxism, and it all kind of makes sense within a scheme. It's about keeping themselves in power, and in order to keep themselves in power, they've aligned themselves at different times with different groups. And so, you know, in the 90s and even the early 2000s, Putin often sounded very Western. He aligned, you know, there are many people in Moscow who have big business interests here, as we know. You know, many of them live here in the UK. And so when it's useful to them, they can sound as much a part of the Western sort of plutocracy as anybody else. And there are, they certainly have important relationships with leading Western capitalists and leading Western democratic politicians, which they use when necessary. At times, they align themselves with nationalist ideas, and with, you know, very, you know, in following the revolution in Ukraine in 2014, very elaborate attempt to argue that the revolution was oppressing Russian speakers inside Ukraine, and they made themselves into the champions of ethnic Russians. And sometimes they use that as an ideology when that suits them. At other times, they use an ideology that you've written a book about, so I'll be interested to hear what you do. It was a Eurasianism, which is a much more a broader idea, you know, that Russia stands for a different kind of civilization, and it represents, you know, and then Russia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and so on represent an alternative to Europe, and it stands for that. So they can use these different, depending on the circumstance and what's going on, they use these different ideologies, which, you know, as you say, opportunistically in order to stay in power. When they project them abroad, once again, they can support the far left. They can support Syriza in Greece. They can support Marine Le Pen in France. In Poland, the Russian information campaign is fascinating because it's often backed anti-Russian groups. So the Russians are not, you know, what they're interested in Poland is backing chaos and anti-Westernism and parties and people who are anti-European, you know, and those are often, the same people are often anti-Russian. But they don't care. It's not about promoting Russia. It's not about soft power or promoting an idea of Russia. What they're interested in is promoting chaos, making Poland an unstable country, making it an unstable partner, you know, making sure that Poland doesn't have any influence inside the EU. And I think actually they've done it quite successfully. So the reason why, you know, you said in your remarks, you said, oh, it's, they seem to be anti-Western, but in an unclear way. It's unclear because they're operating on different fronts in different countries. I mean, literally, there's a different strategy. There's a different line for each country. You know, in each country of Europe, they have a different group of people who they back. You know, in the United States, as we, you know, they've actually been aligned with Trump for a decade. What does Trump represent? Does he represent an identifiable ideology? I mean, that's kind of another conversation, but. But they look for people who serve their interests, you know, of different kinds. I imagine their initial interest in Trump was economic. They've bailed out his businesses several times. They, again, sorry to be vague, but Russian businessmen have bailed out Trump's companies a couple of times when he was bankrupt. So they look for influential people. They look for ways into the system almost everywhere they go. And again, you're right that they don't create populism, and they don't create, and certainly don't create anti-Europeanism, and they don't create nationalism. But I think I would not downplay the extent to which they've funded it, provoked it, promoted it, you know, pushed it on social media, And in, you know, again, it differs in different countries, but I mean, in one or two countries that I've looked at carefully, they have done so extremely successfully, and they've helped make small, unimportant movements into very big ones. So it's not, I agree, it's not the source of problems, and I think actually here it's not that important, but in Slovakia, you know, in the Czech Republic, in Poland, I even think in Italy, they have, they've been, it's been quite influential.
So, Alex, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, well, I think, probably if we talk about Putin a little bit, a lot has been made about his KGB background, but to me personally, I think much more important and often neglected, his experience, formative experience, was in the 1990s in St. Petersburg. That's because that's where he... And that was a period of transition from communism to wild capitalism.
It wasn't even capitalism, to be fair.
Russian capitalism, right. So the formative experience was then, if you look at his people surround him, almost all of them come from this period in power. Mm-hmm. Not all of them are KGB, so if you look at the economic, people who are in charge of the economy, Russian economy, the two most influential here was German Greif and the Alexei Kudrin. They come from St. Petersburg. They are very pro-liberal economic, reformers, still influential, and a few others as well. So basically, at the same time, of course, there is a very important reliance on Putin's on so-called Siloviki, the strongman in various
military
KGB security services, police. Often there's a system of check and balances. They kind of they spy on each other and kind of trying to mind each other and so forth. There's a big case at the moment in Russia. There's one, the head of the person in charge of the anti-corruption economic crimes has been caught with $120 million in his flat in cash. So there's kind of still question. Well, in his sister's flat, and he doesn't see her very often.
But I always wonder when they talk about finding, the Chinese are always finding people with hundreds of millions of dollars in cash. That must take up a lot of space.
Oh, it's the huge. It's basically huge bags of paper from there to here. It's enormous.
You have to have a big flat.
You have to have a big flat. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's not any
cash.
Flat. Yeah. So, but anyway, so there's that element to it. But if you look at Russian, the dynamic of Russian politics and why Putin came to the top, established himself and became relatively popular was actually he sold himself in the early 2000s on negating the excesses of the 1990s, particularly what was happening in Russia was a redistribution of wealth from the Yeltsin's oligarchs in the 1990s who privatized things for next to nothing, all the Russian industry, towards Putin's friends, who were relatively minor people in the 1990s, and now they became quite influential. But at the same time, there also was a transference of wealth from private companies, for example, Yukos, Khodorkovsky, which was private, into Rosneft, which is run by Putin's very close friend, Sechin, but it's state-owned, right? So there's also was this element, and that plays very well with the Russian public because essentially the wealth created in the 1990s was seen as being legitimate. What Putin was doing actually was doing justice by taking it from corrupt hands, putting it to the state's hands, and the fact that his friends actually benefited a lot from that. He always was a kind of a secondary importance to many Russians in many ways. The point I was saying about, it's not just about Putin, it's about actually the deeper problem is actually, as I said, because he is popular, that he actually represents very important strand in Russian history, in Russian politics, in Russian identity, and that strand is not... there's a difference between different types of nationalism. One is the ethnic nationalism, the other one in Putin's case and in Russia's case is the so-called statist tradition in Russian history. It's basically the idea of a strong state, so it doesn't matter who is actually running it, but Russia has to have a strong state, it has to be a great power, and that's what basically is the driving kind of, well, that's the only coherent really bit of ideology.
Be careful about this thing about him being popular, because we actually have no idea how popular he really is.
I was going to ask you that. I remember being in Surgut in Siberia in 2008, and I was struck by how popular he was. It was an oil-rich, economically successful sort of boom town, which had a lot of Russian Ukrainians who traveled there, lived there. And I just remember sort of asking a few questions and being struck about that level of popularity. And you said, Alex, that he was initially, he basically had a sort of populist approach to dealing with some of the iniquities or problems in the post.
That's how they sold it. That sort of struck a chord with the public, with some of the public.
So as to that chord and how we measure, I think this is where Anne was going.
Well, we don't know, I mean, we have no idea. Because first of all, the way the media works in Russia, and I mean, really the ideological, the sort of power of Putinism lies in the degree to which he and the team around him control so many levers of power in Russia. I mean, this is the odd thing about Russia, and this is why I think it's so hard for outsiders to understand, is that on the one hand, it is in some ways a weak state. I mean, it has had a lot of economic trouble. It's very dependent on oil. There are big legitimacy problems with the government. Even when you do polls that show that Putin is unpopular, the same poll will show that local governments are very unpopular. People think the system is very corrupt. So, there are big problems with the way the system works. On the one hand, on the other hand, Putin controls the equivalent, it's as if President Obama controlled not just the White House, but also, Congress, the judiciary, BBC, Fox News, CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the CIA, the FBI, and a host of whole other institutions, personally. And because he has this kind of influence, he can keep certain kinds of narratives and certain kinds of arguments out of the public space. So media is about 95% one way or the other controlled by the state, either directly or through companies that are beholden to the state, one way or the other, Gazprom, media, whatever. There is a small and shrinking, actually, sort of independent media, but it reaches very few people. I mean, for a long time, the rule was you could have independent media in Russia as long as not too many people saw it. And actually, even in recent years, that space has grown much smaller. I have a friend who runs a little magazine in Russia who was more or less left alone because she had such a small readership, but now she's even lost access to distribution, so you can't even buy her magazine in kiosks anymore. But because they control the narratives and because they control what people see, and because a lot of thought goes into what it is that people see and what is being shown on television, people don't hear counter-arguments. So saying that Putin is popular is like saying, Stalin was popular. I mean, he was, but there was also no alternative. There's no real, to the degree to which there are alternatives in the political system, they're often Kremlin-created and controlled. And this is something I find people in the West have an enormous amount of trouble understanding. So they'll see, okay, there's an election, there are these other parties, but very often the parties will be also controlled by the Kremlin. So there's a sort of fake opposition, which is allowed to, for example, Zhirinovsky's party. This is sort of crazy, kind of wacky nationalist party. And it's allowed to exist because Putin finds it useful. There needs to be the appearance of opposition, but of course, Zhirinovsky always votes with the Kremlin and is in fact under Kremlin control. So, in a system like that, how do you know who's popular?
Yeah.
And also, in a system where people are increasingly intimidated by the state and by the secret services and so on, how do you conduct an opinion poll? If you call up somebody, ask a taxi driver in Krasnoyarsk, you call him up on the phone and say, hello, this is the polling company from Moscow. Do you like the president? I mean, what are they going to say? Yes. Why would you say anything else? We've also just seen last week, literally, the most respected sort of remaining genuinely supposedly independent polling company in Moscow, which is called Levada, has just been essentially lost, was essentially told that it could no longer operate, and it was accused of being a foreign agent. And this is when it conducted a poll that showed that Putin's party was unpopular. So these questions of popularity are complicated.
Okay, so popularity is hard to measure, and even harder to measure, arguably. What about Putin's personal strength in the system, because it seems to me you've got two things happening simultaneously. On the one hand, you have a weakening of the economic status of Russia and a series of difficulties and a hemorrhaging of population. On the other hand, you have increasing control of the political system, increasing control over the media, and a stronger media ring. So if we can't tell if he's more popular or not than he was 5, 10 years ago, can we tell if he's stronger or not in his place?
Sorry, I've been talking a lot. Would you like to take that first?
I think that what was happening now is actually tomorrow, by the way, is a Russian parliamentary elections, which is was quite interesting because it's first parliamentary elections after the big protests in winter 2011, where there was up to 100,000 people in Moscow protesting against unfair elections to the last Duma elections. What have you been seeing? Actually, they're trying to transform the system a little bit towards moving it. They changed the man in charge of the Russian internal politics, was Vladislav Surkov, for all the years until 2011. Now it's Vyacheslav Volodin, who tried to revamp the system a little bit, to take it more competitive or less pleasantly corrupt in terms of electoral system itself. Yeah. What struck me, I just came back from Russia actually in 2 weeks ago, that's how subdued the campaign is. Nobody takes much interest in it. There's some posters around around the town. I was in St. Petersburg, nobody really talks about it. People talk about economic crisis. They don't really talk about politics, even though there is elections coming up.
It's not very interesting to talk about politics.
Well, but they did talk about politics in 2011.
And there was that's when there seemed like there might be a real competition, and now, you know.
But there was a frustration. There wasn't a real competition. The competition was to undermine the United Russia, to make it appear less popular than it was really projected to be. Nothing like this now, even though now is a much more deep, serious economic crisis. So people do talk about salaries being cut, business not doing well, and so forth. So they did manage somehow to transform the system away from political protests towards economic problems. Putin, more popular. I mean, honestly, don't really see particular danger in terms of, because that was really the big call that something like Maidan was going to happen in Russia in 2011. Nothing like this seems to be on the cards now. For a variety of reasons, so I think they're relatively secure in his power.
There is the scenario that people talk about the most is a kind of palace coup, of which there's very, very long tradition in Russia, going back about 600 years, which is that, you know, if the economy gets too bad and if some of the more powerful business people in Russia begin to lose a lot of money, which has actually started to happen, the sanctions are not good for them, and so on. Then you could see, you know, an attempt to overthrow him from inside, which sort of might or might not be better or worse. But that's something that people do talk about, and occasionally I hear rumors about it. But, you know, predicting that is like predicting the weather. I mean, it's very difficult.
Especially right Northern now, Ireland.
Sorry?
Especially predicting the weather in Northern Ireland.
Exactly, yeah. Predicting the weather in Northern Ireland, exactly. I mean, right now predicting that, and the same goes for, you're right that the street revolution scenario feels impossible, partly because the state has been trying so hard to cut it off. Although, again, you know, Russian history has known those as well. So that's also still not impossible, I think.
I have loads more questions, which I might return back to, but I want to give a chance for the audience to ask any questions they might have. Gentlemen in the front row.
They both said a lot about how they're trying to undermine the West. That's soft ways. Garth George is
Baltic states had a risk of on the military. So this is sort of the million-dollar question. So the Russians have played a lot of games with the Baltic states. There was an Estonian officer who was kidnapped from the Estonian side of the border, a year or so ago. There was a Lithuanian ship that was a fishing boat that was kind of kidnapped, that was held. There have been some gains. I mean, exactly the thing that you point to. There's a train that goes across Lithuania that goes to Kaliningrad. Those of you who don't know the map, you know, there's the three Baltic states, and then there's this little tiny enclave, which is sort of horrifyingly reminiscent of the way Poland was divided in 1939, and there was a German enclave. So, you know, this is what makes people paranoid. This train that goes across Lithuania to Kaliningrad, there's a closed train that goes, and there was one incident where it stopped, and nobody knew what was going on, and the Lithuanians sent army troops to, anyway, there's a lot of fear about what could be on that train and what they could do with it. So there are a lot of games that have been played designed to make the Baltic states nervous. Talking about disinformation, a huge amount of Russian energy, money, information, and so on goes to creating anti-European, anti-state, anti-Latvian parties, in particular in Latvia and Estonia, which are the two countries that have big Russian-speaking populations. The game is played. I mean, I think part of the game is intended just to make people nervous and to make people think, okay, NATO's not doing anything, NATO's not really here. When people feel in that part of the world that NATO isn't, of course, Baltic states are part of NATO, so technically, if they were invaded, there would have to be a Western response. But if people begin to feel there won't be a Western response or it'll be tempered, then that makes people begin to play both sides of the game, and then some people look for allies in Russia and so on. So this may not presage an actual invasion, but there is certainly a lot of pressure is being put on the Baltic states to destabilize them and make them feel less Western. And that, I think, is part of the same game.
Alex, yeah?
I actually was recently just finished a paper on Russian Baltic states. It's a completely different scenario from Crimea or from Georgia, not least because the Russians in Baltic states actually don't want to be in Russia to begin with, because what they want is to be basically come to Northern Ireland or London or wherever have you. Russia's access to Kaliningrad is not such a strategic issue as was kind of loss of naval base and potential loss of naval base in Sevastopol and so forth. And Russia has invested billions of dollars in developing alternative infrastructure around St. Petersburg, basically diverting all the trade it had, particularly in oil, which was very big terminals and ports. Use of ports after the Soviet times. Now it's almost stopped because they just invested billions of dollars into St. Petersburg region, having oil terminals, ports, and so forth there. And of course, the issue there is that although they feel nervous, they're still part of NATO, and any action against the Baltic states would mean action against NATO. Russians know that they don't want it. What they do want is exactly increase the pressure, essentially, particularly in the context of the Ukrainian conflict, because the Baltic states are the Achilles heel of NATO. They are vulnerable, militarily vulnerable to potential Russian invasion. So kind of rattling up sort of pressure around them keeps NATO on the toes and basically tells them, do you really want to get involved with us? Issue of Ukraine, particularly supply of lethal weapons and so forth. So basically it's kind of forcing NATO to recognize Russia's strength, importance, and engage them in some kind of new deal in Europe.
Yeah, and there are a lot of fears that Russia might not invade the Baltic states, but might, I've seen a lot of scenarios of a kind of hybrid war. You know, for example, there might be an incident with, native ethnic Russians on the Latvian side of the border, and the Russians might send in a team of, policemen to go and help rescue them from some kind of situation. Then is that an invasion? You know, what is it? Should NATO respond? If so, how? You know, what kind of response would there be? And other, you know, the other scenarios, like, for example, with this train. I mean, I agree with you that there's no strategic significance really to Kaliningrad, but you could play a game with the train. You could fill it with troops, or it could catch fire. And then the Russians would send a fire team, you know, firemen from the other side of the border. And then is NATO respond, or does it, you know... So there are a lot of, you know, these are scenarios I've seen written out or possibilities that people have suggested. So that's possible. It doesn't seem like there would be any sense in actually invading. Although the one thing I would caution is that if Putin does look closer to losing power, he may want to do something spectacular to stay in power. And that's, of course, one of the areas where he could do something spectacular.
Yeah. I have a question.
Is the West playing Putin wrong? Is there a way, you know, if we were, if you like, more respectful of Russian pride, that we would be able diplomatically and strategically to sort of defuse what it feels like an increasingly tense situation?
Well, I think that's what I was trying to say, is a bit what really Russians look for is a new deal, a new security deal in Europe, because for them, the enlargement of NATO, potentially, and they also recently securitized enlargement of European Union as well, although that's really not, was not going to happen anyway, but nevertheless, they perceive it as a danger, as a security threat. So going back to the original point, Russia has failed to westernize, failed to integrate into Western structures. How do you deal with it now? You know, you have to find a new way. Hoping for an overthrow of Putin and a new guy who will be Western is not going to work. So you have to deal with Russia what you have now. The statist nationalist feeling deeper than Putin. We can disagree about the opinion polls, but my understanding, my feeling is that there is a nationalist turn in Russia, not ethnic nationalism, but although that as well, but statist turn. Russia is challenging its place in its own neighborhood as being a great power, and it was forced the NATO, the West, to recognize it and to come to some term of new accommodation, which was different from what was in the 1990s. And that's basically the challenge. You know, how do you deal with it? And there are various ways of dealing with it. You can deal it with trying to engage diplomatically, or you can engage in a hostile way through sanctions and so forth. But basically, that's the agenda. That's agenda for European security in the next decades, is to how to deal with Russia, which is not going to be part of the West. You know, still have to deal with it.
I would argue that deterrence worked before, and it could work again. And that the, you know, first of all, you know, the main thing the West could do is recognize the problem and acknowledge the problem. And in particular, the nature of the problem, that it's not just military. You know, because actually NATO thinks a lot about Russia, and the U.S. Army in Europe thinks tremendous amount about Russia. But I'm not so sure that, you know, the Italian government is interested in Russian information influence or business influence inside Italy, or the British government inside the U.K. And I think, you know, for countries to recognize the problem and begin to come up with strategies to push back against it, I think is really the beginning of the problem.
Yeah.
Beginning of the solution.
Well, I think we have time for one more question. Just the young man at the back there.
But we do.
Yeah.
I didn't hear all of that.
Okay, I think the question was, should the West leave Russia to its own devices and we interfere too much? And to which I'll add another question, which goes to the heart of the US presidential election. I was desperate at some point to get on to Trump, which always brings out in the audience either a look of amusement, horror, or perhaps even sneaking admiration for some of you. You know who you are. And that actually goes to the heart of the young man's question, which is there is a debate in America right now in the US and as to what the West is, and there's a less coherent idea as to what our first line of defense is, what is in our national interest. That's suddenly surging back into the public domain. I noticed the front page of the National Interest magazine recently had a leading article with a detente 2.0. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do you make the case? I mean, so yours is the Trump line, if you don't mind me saying, which is this isn't our business. How do you make the case otherwise? How do you say to those in the West, this does matter to you, in you know, beyond
so,
what
so happens
in
local
states?
So first of all, I agree that Russian politics isn't our business in that sense. I mean, I don't think we have any influence inside Russia. I don't think we are playing inside the Russian political space. I mean, even if kind of theoretically I would like to do that, I didn't see any desire to do that or anyone who's doing it. So I don't think it's correct to say we're involved in Russia. You know, much as maybe in theory I would like us to be, we aren't. And I'm not sure we would know how to be anymore. So that's not happening. There's a different question, which is, should we be concerned about Europe? I mean, the countries which have chosen to join the EU and NATO, is this a matter of concern to Britain and to the United States? And that I would say, yes, there is a huge concern. The basis of European and American, the sort of Western wealth and influence, is the presumption of stability within our borders, at the very least. I mean, we've chosen not to include Ukraine inside that zone of stability. We've very much chosen not to include Georgia. You know, we don't include Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova. I mean, I think there was an interest in at least spreading some Western ideas, idea of rule of law and so on to those countries, and, you know, that may or may not succeed. You know, so far it's mixed views. But within the space of the West, preserving stability, preserving the basis for trade, preserving the basis for free exchange of people and ideas, I think is hugely important. It's the foundation of our wealth. It's the foundation of our influence. And it's very, very important to protect it. And whether we're protecting it against the Russians or we're protecting it against, you know, populism or protecting it against terrorism, I mean, these are all different facets of the same thing. You know, I think it's, you know, very, very much in our interest, and that's certainly an argument that can be made by Western politicians.
But it's a harder argument to win these days.
It's a harder argument to win only because there are much louder voices against it than there used to be. And I also think that people haven't, it's been a long time since people thought through or spoke about openly about the advantages. There's been a kind of assumption that, oh, okay, we're in NATO, that's good. But there hasn't been, I mean, I can't remember the last British prime minister who attempted to sell it or explain it. I think not since the 1990s. Well, has anybody really spoken about what are the advantages of having this zone of stability that stretches from, you know, Belfast to, you know, Białystok, and why that's good for Britain and why it's good for British business?
Alex, would you like to comment on that?
I think Russia doesn't really threaten. I don't know. I feel that Russia's influence in the EU is hugely overblown, because basically it can't even control its former Soviet space. None of the former Soviet republics recognized either independence of Abkhazia, South Ossetia, or Russia's annexation of Crimea, although there was a lot of Russian pressure to do them. The relations even within the former Soviet Union is much more complex than it's just they do what Putin tells them to do. If it's can't control in that, I mean, it's much more nuanced, complex. Russia's interested in European market, economic partnership, and so forth. Its turn to China is not won't be able to compensate for the huge investment already existing trade with European Union. There is a lot of frustration and mutual suspicion on both sides at the moment, both on Russian side and the Western side. A lot of it is justified, some of it is not, but as I said, at some point you have to kind of come to some form of settlement with Russia, which might mean pushing it back, but at some point you still have to kind of engage dialogue, simply kind of standing up. I don't think it's enough in the long term.
Okay, well, that's, I guess, potentially an optimistic note from which to end. I've had the chop-off sign, the dictatorial chop-off sign from Ivo. I'd like to say, just in terms of the topic of the conversation, was Russia malevolent or misunderstood, really sort of jumped out at me as quite spiky and potentially explosive. But actually, the arguments and discussions have been utterly nuanced. And for most of the conversation,
Right? It was a conversation and not a fight.
Finally, tribute to you, Anne. You know, you might not have liked the title, but it's worked perfectly. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your time. I can see the sun shining through.
Thanks.
Thank you.